Hello, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Will Vincent. This week, I'm joined by Robbie Groden of Path AI to talk about how they're using Django at scale. Hi, Robbie.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about your background, how you got into programming. Why don't we start there?
Sure, that sounds great. So, I grew up in New Jersey, and I went to school at Northeastern here in Boston for music technology, which is electronic music composition and synthesis and, all kinds of, just focusing on using technology to make and analyze music. So different background than you're typically, going to hear in these types of cases. But while I was working with those tools, and also I got a really cool part-time job at a company nearby called Cakewalk that makes music technology software, I was able to get really close to the tools that I was using to make music. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. How do people make this stuff? And I took a summer class in SuperCollider, which is a Lisp derivative that you use to generate music. And I kind of just picked it up really quickly and was like, oh, cool, I want to learn more about this. Added another major, and I just kind of took off from there, was immediately getting involved in projects like the Java Music Specification Language, adding XML parsers to that, and started working. I did a co-op. The Northeastern has a great co-op system. I got to work at BlackBerry for 6 months, and,
Was this back when BlackBerry was a real thing, or had they started the decline?
This was actually this was in 2010 when they were RIM. And nowadays I have to say BlackBerry because everyone's like, right, what's RIM? But this was actually when everything exploded. This is when all the layoffs happened.
Right, because the iPhone came out in, 2007, I think?
Yeah.
So you finally... And was this up in Canada, right?
No, actually, so they have I don't know if they still have it, a satellite office in Andover. It's about, 30, 40 people. So it was
Andover, Mass.
Yeah, Andover, Mass. So I was on part of the core MMS, SMS team, which is just located there. It's a random team to be located there. But
very interesting to work at a company at that stage, though.
Yeah, it was interesting. I didn't really learn a whole lot of positive things, I would say. I learned a lot of things that I want to avoid and mistakes that can be made, but it was definitely a cool anecdote to have early on in my career that has followed me.
Mm-hmm. So I want to focus as much as we can on Path AI, where you are now, and how you're using Django, but I think you've also worked at a couple other really interesting companies, I think Box as well.
Yeah, so after I graduated, I moved out to San Francisco. I went to a music tech startup that literally a month after I got there folded, which was
right,
a weird situation for me as a new college grad whose girlfriend moved out with him as well. And then I ended up at Visa for a short period of time. Corporate environments, I don't last long there. So I did go to Box for a year, which was really cool. That was my first experience of getting to work on APIs at scale.
In what languages and frameworks were you using?
Yeah, so it was PHP, okay. the dirty PHP. And it was great, though. I got to learn a lot of really cool things about reliability. I was a code reliability engineer on their content API team. So I got to learn what happens when things fail catastrophically. So to this day, every time I'm kicking off a project with someone, I always ask them, well, but what happens when this fails catastrophically?
Right. Well, and that's great because it's hard to get that experience unless you are already at scale.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what we're going to focus on today. There's so many things that until you've blown up a huge database or had these problems, it's hard to mimic it.
Yeah.
In the abstract.
It's hard to see around the corner if you've never been there.
Right. So we're recording this here in Boston. And, like you, I used to live out in the Bay and now I'm back in Boston. So I always like to ask people, what brought you back?
That's actually a very nuanced question. I'll be honest, and the culture out there, professional culture, is really not for everyone. So it really just was not for me. I think, I kind of went out there with this goal in mind of I want to spend a year or two here, and I want to really try to jumpstart my career, work at difficult companies, get a lot of experience. It's just something about the environment. It was a little bit too much tech all the time. So I remember
That's a very East Coast attitude, but I agree with it. It's because even here in Boston, I mean, there's a lot of tech, but there's a lot of medicine. There's a lot of other things out there. I mean, it's amazing, especially at first, but it is really all tech all the time.
It is. I recall because live music is my biggest passion. And I remember going to a concert and not being able to hear the band over people talking about their startups in my ear.
Right. Every cafe is.
Yeah.
It's okay, good.
Can't escape it.
So now, Path AI, so you've been here, a year now?
No.
6 months?
Yeah, closer to 6 months, yeah.
And then what's the quick pitch for listeners? What is Path AI?
Great. So Path AI's goal is to be the world's computational pathologist. So we look at pathology as the ground truth in medicine, right?
Can you explain what pathology is?
Absolutely. So let's say you've got some concern, or your doctor has some concern about a mole on your body or a lump, etc. You go and you get a biopsy. So that's just a bunch of matter taken out of your body, a small amount of matter really, and placed onto slides. So historically speaking, to make a diagnosis, and if there is a diagnosis, then to discuss or recommend treatment, what a pathologist would do is look at that glass slide through a microscope. And that is the same way it's been for hundreds of years. And it's incredibly error prone.
What kind of levels?
So discordance amongst pathologists, for some of the more common diagnoses, you're looking at like a 6% discordance rate. But now if you're talking about some of the more difficult, small tumors or some of the more rare diseases, this could get upwards of 30 to even 45, close to 50% discordance, which means you might as well be flipping a coin.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a very brittle process. And, you know, pathologists, they look at hundreds of slides a day and they only really get a few minutes each. So looking through a microscope, when you realize you could have about 250,000 cells on a given slide, it's like trying to find all the blue cars in Boston from a, from a satellite view.
And yeah,
that's a parallel that we like to make. So what we're doing is we're offering a GPS to pathologists. We're showing them where to look at the slide. We're giving them some quantitative analysis on the slide that the computer does. We're not replacing the pathologist, but we're trying to augment their ability to affect a diagnosis and to properly treat the patient. Right now, though, so we're a pretty young company. Been around for like 3 years officially. I mean, the first year was like two guys in a basement, of course, as most good startup stories go. And as most Boston startup stories go, one founder was from Harvard Medical School, or Harvard, one was from MIT. That's just the way it works, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right now we're only effectively being used in pharmacology research, but we are building out, and this is really exciting for me because I'm on this team, and just because it's a really cool first step for this company and a great opportunity in the tech space, we are building out a medical device. So really impacting the lives of patients everywhere.
Wow. And it's interesting that you guys, from the get-go, you're trying to enhance the pathologist. You're not trying to replace them.
I mean, that's my personal philosophy on technology, is that good technology should always augment a human, not replace them. So an analytical tool should surface information to an analyst rather than just output a decision that we just take for granted as being true.
And is that the same in, because I think radiology is the other medical space where there's a lot of excitement around using computers. Is it a similar thing there, or is it the thought more that they can totally replace radiologists?
I wish I could actually give you a more informed opinion, but I actually don't really know much about radiology.
Okay.
In fact, so this is my first job in the health tech space.
Yeah.
And we don't expect anyone coming in as an engineer, especially, or any other role that's not directly related to the biology or pathology, to know these things. But they've been doing a really phenomenal job of upskilling all the employees here and kind of teaching us about the different concepts of the pathology. I'm still a baby brain pathologist,
But I'm sure osmosis, and you're working with it every day. So
totally. But I have been hearing from people who are in the radiology space that they're equally as excited. And that's something that I think is really worth looking into.
Very cool. So you said you joined about 6 months ago. Why did PathAI choose Django? Was it always Django from the beginning? What do you know about that journey?
Yeah. So originally the application was built in Java using the Play framework. So the first stage of the PathAI product was more of a service-based business. So it wasn't really so much a product, so much as a means to help our partners conduct this research. So it was very a la carte, very much like, oh, you need this feature? Cool, let me go throw that into the code base real quick, close the contract,
interesting,
make
the
money.
That's a way to fund it, I guess, starting out is to be, yeah.
So we hired a VP of product design and engineering, Jackson Wilkinson from care.com. And he came over with a wealth of experience in a lot of things, including building Django applications. So he, in my opinion, correctly identified a move to Python as being the ideal solution for some of the engineering issues we'd had. So one of the issues that you have whenever you have a Java platform is hiring engineers. It is very hard to hire Java engineers. I've done it in the past, and you run up against this problem where either they are not very experienced in Java, which is fine, but it can be a bit of a beast to wrap your head around if you've never worked with it.
Yeah.
Or they're really good at Java, which means they're happily employed.
Yeah, there's less of that middle ground.
Yeah, precisely. And I feel like as an educator, it's I've taught people Java and I've taught people Python. And for me, getting somebody to learn Java is very difficult because it feels very alien, very foreign, especially if you're used to something like Ruby or Python that feels more natural.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I started with Python and JavaScript, and I only several years in looked at Java, and I did a couple undergrad courses, and it was just you know, like walking to the fridge on my hands. Like I could do it, but why would I do it?
Yeah.
Not everyone shares that point of view, but you really, you just the print statement, I think it's something like 12 lines in Java versus.
Yeah.
So it's seeing, you know, and there's value in learning, you know, just the structure and, you know, the it's being static typing and all that, but
yeah.
It's hard to go to it when, you know, there's something like Python and then, and actually I don't know the Play framework very well, but Django in particular is pretty nice to use.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Play framework's not bad, I would say. Like, it's not like terrible. It works. It's worked for us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not to diss it at all, but I think that for where we want to be a year from now, as far as size, scale, and the types of problems we want to be solving, Python just makes more sense. You know, when I teach Python, one of the things I do is, you know, I say, well, why are we learning Python today? Because I'm really here to teach you how to code, but I really want to teach you Python. And I pull up, there's a website, I'm not sure what the URL is, but it's it has Hello World in every language.
Yeah, now I see, yeah, it's like 100 different languages. Yeah, we'll link to it in the notes.
Yeah, so I always show them, here's Java, 20 lines.
Yeah.
Here's Python, one line. And then for fun, I show them Brainfuck or LOL code or, you know, all the fun ones. But,
Yeah. No, that site is a great way. I mean, it's a slightly unfair comparison, but there's some truth to it.
Yeah. For a beginner, at least. I mean, you know,
sure.
Every tool has its use, but if your goal is to learn a language,
mm-hmm.
starting with Java just feels unfair.
So then, and I know this is before your time, but do you have a sense of what that transition was like? I mean, you know, because we've been on the podcast talking about new Django projects, but in the real world, often you are migrating, you know, from something else.
Yeah, no, actually, so I joined at a really exciting time. So when I had joined, PathAI had just really... It was just like a few months into that transition. So the first step of that transition for PathAI was to transition from MySQL to Postgres for various reasons. So that had been completed. And then the first attempt at spinning up a new new Django application was made. Now, the goal was not necessarily to just port everything over to Django.
Hmm.
The goal, and I think this is the right way to work with legacy code, in my opinion, is to support a Java application. Do not do any new development in Java, though. Start all that new development in Django. And as thing, you know, technical debt arises, new features that have to touch other areas of the code change, you start porting things over slowly. Or like, you know, what I did was create a laundry list of these, you know, API endpoints with the help of my coworkers that we can then pick the easy ones to port over. And every time we hire a new dev, their first task is just create a CRUD endpoint in Django and sunset the Java endpoint.
Nice. And I assume that's Java... Django REST framework you're using?
Yeah, so we use DRF. So that first attempt was actually microservices. We ran into this a few issues there, though. We didn't have a lot of engineers. We had like 5 or 6 engineers. So every new microservice that spun up, we, you know, was another microservice that someone had to own. So we had people owning multiple services, and it just got a little messy. Also, we wanted to share code between the two.
Right. Well, and can you just... So what does it mean to spin up a microservice with Django?
So, you know, we... So that was kind of one of the issues, is we didn't really fully define that. So
Right. Some,
you know, everyone's kind of building their own services in their own way. So, you know, we use Docker and to kind of create that virtual environment to set up our applications. So we kind of had like what we thought was a standardized Docker file, but we realized that the services had kind of diverged pretty quickly. So, you know, things were just not really consistent, and we found that people wanting to contribute code to some sort of, or sorry, share code across those two services, two main services, because we had a lot of other smaller services, it just got a little arduous. We realized we'd end up having all these GitHub repositories with like core utilities that would have to be like pip installed, and it just didn't quite make sense.
So is each one like a Django, like a self-defined Django project where you start? Okay.
Everything, yeah, you start, you run the Django start project.
Got it.
You get it set up in Docker,
mm-hmm.
And then just kind of get going.
And how is, just not to get too off track, but sure. I'm working a lot with Docker and my new book, and how are you finding Docker with Django? Because I find it's a little bit of a Wild West still.
Yeah, so this was actually...
and you're using pip?
Or sorry, we use pipenv.
Pipenv, okay, yeah, I use... Yeah, we should talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. So this was actually my first real... attempt at using Docker. I've used it in the past, but not, I say real as in like first scaled application with Docker, and one where I've actually had to really get in there and edit like the Docker compose and everything.
Yeah.
I think with Django, we've found a way that works, but there are definitely occasional gotchas
yeah.
that, you know, we have to kind of think about.
Versus like pip?
Yeah, versus just like using Pip. But I think, you know, given that we have like a front end team that, you know, sometimes they can hit staging, but sometimes they can't, just because our environments are still in their infancy. Being able to quickly spin up a Docker container on a front end dev's computer and not having them worry about what's inside of it is actually a huge benefit.
Yeah. Well, and in a team setting too, to, you know, to be on the same image.
Yeah.
Is, yeah.
I think it's good because, you know, as somebody, so I'm an application engineer. I don't want to think about the infrastructure as more than I have to. That's just the way that I am as a person. For me, I find it a great source of comfort knowing that like we've vetted these Docker compose commands. We know that we're going to be able to set up the environment the same way locally and on each other's computers and on prod and staging.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know. It just gives me a sense of ease that I haven't had before.
And I mean, I've found the main, you know, the challenge with Docker is you want to kind of just use it and, you know, someone gives you a recipe and it works until it doesn't. And then you have to really learn Docker and, you know, things like containers are ephemeral, you know, rebuilding images. I mean, that's a big one with pipenv is when you, where do you generate the lock file?
Yeah. So we generate locally and check in the lock file. And we have had, you know, merge conflicts in a lock file stink.
Yeah. There's two ways to do it. I mean, the problem, right, is you create the lock file locally. And sometimes if it's in the container, you get conflicts. I mean, what I've done is I've found if I do it within Docker and then through the volumes, it'll be copied over. And then I spin down the container and then I rebuild it with the build flag to force rebuild. That kind of works for me, but it's sort of, it doesn't matter which one you do as long as you're consistent, but you get some really nasty bugs with, you know, the lock file in particular.
Oh yeah. I think most devs here do everything inside of the Docker container.
Yeah. I try to do everything I can inside of it. But I think the fact that the files automatically sync, but the database doesn't.
You know,
that's a real, that takes a while to internalize.
Well, we also put our databases into a Docker container. So for local development, we have a, and this is mainly used for, so in like a self-contained environment, so we have some repos where everything is all in the same repo, and that's mainly for clinical purposes that it's just better to have even, and I know it sounds kind of grody, but like having the front end and back end in the same repo, we've been able to make it work with Docker. It's not desirable, but it's easier again for the regulatory affairs process. So for that, we'll have the database that just gets spun up as its own, you know, command. It'll be like, you know, just, we'll have the database image and then we'll just use the relies on keyword to make sure that gets spun up. But for other purposes, when we have multiple services that need to hit the same database, we'll just have a separate, we have this repo called local dev Docker. And what it is it just, you spin it up, it has the database there and we use a local internal network. Mm-hmm. So all of our applications can talk to it. The idea being like, you shouldn't be using a local database to connect to a, you know, a container that's supposed to replicate what's happening on prod, because your local database won't be, the whole point is to keep everything consistent. So,
Yeah.
I mean, your mileage may vary on this. And also this is like my first time really getting into this, but I think it's been really cool to get to learn that.
Yeah. I mean, when you work on stuff at scale, you realize things like a production database is massive. And how do you, at Quizlet, we took like a 10th of all the files. So we had a version that we could use locally, there's a whole separate episode we could do on that.
Yeah. Well, for us, I mean, there's also considerations about data, because the data that we have on prod cannot live on our laptops.
Right. You've got all those additional concerns.
But in this space, because, you know, this isn't new, like health tech is, I think this is a really exciting time for health tech, because a lot of other people have made a lot of strides. There is an open source data set, the TCGA data set, that people in this space can use. And that way we can have slide images and metadata about those slides locally. But we're not breaking any rules.
Oh, I see that solves a lot of problems.
It does. It's very helpful.
So something that we've talked about previously is that, you know, many Django applications are, you've got a lot of users, a little bit of data, but in your case, you have a small number of users. And like, can you talk about the sizes of data you're dealing with?
Yeah. An image of a slide could be anywhere from 2 gigabytes to 20 gigabytes.
Wow. Okay. So, but 2 gigabytes massive. On the small size.
2 gigabytes on small. Let's call it 10 gigabytes, right? Roughly. So you figure like, if I've got like a phone with 64 gigs of memory, you get 6 images on your phone and that's it.
Yeah.
So massive data, but like not, so when I was at Wayfair, so I spent 3.5 years working at Wayfair. And when I talked about big data, it was just a lot of information, lots of rows. I mean, I was working with Clickstream data on one of the world's biggest e-commerce websites. So like that was like run a query, even though it's on Vertica, you still got to go walk to Starbucks and then come back and you get your results.
Right. Or you get the modern, my code is compiling.
Exactly. Like my query is completing. Or like you come back and you've got a few messages from one of the DBAs like, dude, I hate you. I killed your query.
Yeah.
I'm guilty. But yeah, so the data that we have, it's not massive quantities of data. It's just that it's a large amount of data. And when you log into our platform, you've got things like asset management, project management, personnel management for users within your org, but mainly we have slide management. And when you have slides, you click on a slide, you got to be able to view that slide. And we use a tile server, much like Google Maps, so you can zoom in and out to crazy like depths. We have a deep zoom image tile server that we've built up. And each of those tiles can be a few megs if we're talking lossless here.
And so is a modern pathologist just looking at a computer screen then?
That's our goal. Yeah, is to...
Not yet, but well, maybe soon.
So now, and this is also, again, I'm coming up against the limits of my customer knowledge, but, you know, there are, I believe that there are more forward-thinking, you know, environments where currently that is, you know, slide scanners do exist. They're out in the wild. Digitizing a slide image is not unheard of. So it is happening now. And I think, especially in the research area. But again, you go to those, you know, you go to any local hospital, you go in the basement to the pharma.
Right. It's always in the basement. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Their pathology lab. Yeah. They're going to be looking through microscopes.
Yeah. Well, because I know the radiology world just a little bit through some friends, really. And I know in their case, they have like $10,000 screens because it needs to be super sharp. And I would assume it's the same thing.
That would be nice.
It will be. I mean, because if you have these gigabyte size images, yeah, you hope you have a nice screen to...
You'd think so.
Or is it more about all the levels that you can go through? So that's what...
Yeah, it's really about being able to like zoom in to like a super high amount of just really getting in there and seeing it at a high fidelity.
Got it. So now something else you and I have talked about, so we both have backgrounds teaching and hiring actually, is hiring Django developers, right? Because there's an industry-wide problem of no one wants to hire junior developers. And you have some thoughts on this matter.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because you guys are actively, you're hiring and interviewing a lot of people right now,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. We are. So we're not doing the like hyper growth thing. Hyper growth is just like, it sounds gross and therefore it is. So we are scaling up though. So right now we're at 58 employees. By the end of the year, we want to be at 100 employees. I want to say like maybe roughly 20% or 20 to 40% of that is engineering.
What's the other percent?
So we have ML engineers as well. When I say engineering, sorry, I'm thinking more like product engineering, but okay. ML is obviously our product as well. So we have ML engineering. We have, you know, people who work in regulatory affairs. We've got IT. We've got, you know, various HR related roles, and we have a pathologist. We'll probably be adding more to that team, hopefully.
And is so the machine learning, is that like PhDs, or can you come in and work on that out of college?
Yeah, so that's PhDs. So that's like machine vision, that's like PhDs. That's the really heady stuff that like my background as a quote unquote data scientist, where right, I was working in pandas and doing time series analysis is meaningless.
Okay. But on the website anyways, so what number did you say for?
So I think we currently have...
Well, how many are you trying to hire?
Oh, we have...
Because I'm curious, like just through, like what is the process of hiring, you know, is it 20, 30 people over?
So yeah, we have about like, yeah, for the rest of the year, we want to hire about 15 to 20 people, I think, for engineering. And that's not even counting like co-op and or interns.
Right. And even in Boston, which has a good engineering culture, it's
hard.
Hard.
It's very hard. It's also very hard when you're a young company that knows what it wants, but is not, we're not typical. We are a very atypical company.
Yeah.
So I think when I hear the word junior, it's like, what does that word even mean? I don't really like the word. Like the idea is that we're trying to hire people with a high upside, with high potential. This is a long play. This is, again, not hyper growth. We're not going to churn and burn our customers. We're not going to churn and burn our employees either. So I don't want to hire an engineer, burn them out in 6 to 12 months, and then get another one. That's not the goal. We want to hire people who are going to be a part of this company for the long haul. They're going to learn a lot, and they're going to grow a lot within what we're doing. So we're not looking for Django engineers. Granted, if we get a Django engineer, really exciting, because there's not a lot of them, right? Like there's not a lot of people who dedicate themselves to Django.
It doesn't feel like there is. I often have this conversation with people. As big as Django is, I feel like it's not sometimes it feels like a very small world.
Yeah. But I mean, you can, with the exceptions of like, you know, Pinterest and I think Instagram's on Django as well.
Yeah.
You don't have a lot of huge Django apps out there, like massive scale Django apps.
Yeah, Discus.
Yeah.
I guess there's what, edX here in Boston. They're sort of mid-level.
Yeah. So they're out there, but it's not like a stone throw can hit five companies using Django. I think from my experience that Flask tends to be the more popular web framework in these types of companies. And that's, you know, I built dozens of web frameworks in Flask working at companies like Wayfair and Solaria. And it just, it's
is that more because it's just easier to do something small in Flask or microservices, or what do you think that is?
I think it's partially that, but I think, you know, the fact of the matter is when you work at a large company that is scaling, you have a lot of opinions.
Yeah.
And Django has its own opinions.
Oh, that's yeah.
And one of the reasons that I tend to prefer hiring less experienced, you know, engineers is because they have less opinions, or at least that's not true. I don't think that they should have less opinions. I want engineers to have opinions, but I want them to be loosely held. Django's opinions are not loosely held.
No.
And we butted up. So we had a big misstep that I think we made, which was, let me rephrase that as a big learning opportunity that we had early on, was splitting up our Postgres database into two separate schemas, not using the public schema.
Oh.
Which Django doesn't support. Because Django, that's a Postgres specific concept. And Django is meant to be, while it is, you know, obviously Postgres is the first class, you know, citizen of Django, it's meant to be database agnostic.
Yeah.
So I, myself and another platform engineer, we sat in a room for 2-3 days straight. It was an interesting 3 days trying to hack Python into being okay with our setup. And we got it so that it would work in prod. It was fine. But being able to spin up a test database with multiple schemas, it just, we could do it. It's just the lengths at which we had to go felt gross.
Yeah. And I see a lot of companies have this issue where there's, you know, yeah, Django isn't quite what they want. And then they, at some point they customize it and then they're kind of off the train of updates and
it's like, why are you using Django?
Yeah. That makes more sense with Flask. I mean, cause yeah, once you're off, it's really hard to get back on.
Yeah.
But as you say, I mean, I'm biased towards, there's something nice about guardrails.
I agree. I mean, look, I've done some low-level Flask hacking, and it's fun in the way that driving down the highway at 120 miles an hour is fun, but at the end of the day, it's not sustainable.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, this isn't a, you know, attacking Flask.
No, podcast, I love Flask.
But it's good to have these use cases and talk about, you know, maybe some of the reasons why Django isn't at... as common at huge companies, just because you have, as you said, lots of opinions, lots of things you need to do. And if Django doesn't fully fit it, you might be tempted to.
But for us, like we have a very simple product that we're building. Like at the end of the day, what my team is building is not revolutionary in that many ways. Like the machine learning team, they're building state-of-the-art cutting edge technology that is going to take us being the human race, into a really interesting time where we can actually have more effective diagnoses. And this is a problem that I myself, as a consumer, you know, have seen my loved ones sit across from doctors and get a diagnosis that the doctor was not confident in.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. But all we're doing is taking data and moving it back and forth. Like we're showing slides to users. We're taking their, you know, annotations and comments and storing them in our database and displaying them. We're not really, again, with scale, we're not trying to build something that's a highly available web service that knows everything about every user and uses bidstream data and does this. It's not marketing tech. It's not,
right.
You know, it's not high speed transactions for like, you know, trading. And
yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
So, I think Django works great for us. I built a lot of tools in Flask. I love Flask. I teach Flask often to, you know, people who want to learn how to build their first API, because you can do it in a matter of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I taught a 10-week long class at General Assembly on Python web development, and about halfway through is when we actually focus on Flask. So this is meant to be people who have never coded before. So the first like 5 weeks are like, what is Python? Yeah, what is Python? What's a print statement? You know, what is this weird terminal thing you're using?
Yeah.
It's weird. When we hit Flask, everyone's like, all right, buckle up. And I'm like, okay, we do this, we do this, we do this, and we have an API. And they're like, oh.
It is very magical.
It is. And Django is the same thing, though. I remember the first API I built in Django was an API that was meant to be used for an interview case where if for front-end developers, we would build the API and they would build the front-end.
Oh, yeah, okay.
When I interviewed at Solari, we actually did practical interviews only where you had to build something. So as a back-end dev, I had to build a chat bot in 2 hours. And I did it using Flask and WebSockets.
Yeah.
So I remember when I did this in Django, because my boss at the time was a really big Django fan. And I remember creating the models. I remember creating the serializers and then saying, all right, so now what? How do I get routes? And he's like, or no, and then I create the views, of course. And I say, okay, now how do I get the routes? He's like, no, no, you're done. I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, just run it and hit this endpoint. I was like, but I didn't define that the get or the post. What? It was mind blowing to me as a Flask developer.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was what the view sets then you're using.
Or sorry. Yeah. View sets. Yeah.
So yeah.
You just create it was all generics. I mean, this was like three models and like nothing interesting at all. Mm-hmm. No function based anything.
That makes sense in an interview setting. It's true. Yeah. I mean, view sets are, I think we'll dive deep into Carlton and I'll dive deep into them at some point. They're very powerful and they can work great if you have standard needs. I think a lot of times you need to do something a little bit more and you can, but
no, absolutely.
Certainly to just like get up and going, it's like, oh yeah, it's everything it's like they read my mind.
Yeah. And I mean, that's been a big thing here, like just kind of through education, you know, mentoring people who haven't used Django before is like, let's start with view sets. And then, but like, don't forget to also then follow up with the front end team, because oftentimes the front end team doesn't know that things can be better. So for example, to create, projects in our database for our partners, you have to create, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 different models on a single API call. And originally it was being done with like 6 or 7 API calls because it was all RESTful. It was all transactional.
Did you guys do nested API calls? And
I mean, at the time, like, yes, but they were kind of hacked. They weren't exactly like formatted in a RESTful way. At the time we didn't, though. It was, sorry. At the time that this project had started, no, it was all transactional, nothing nested. And now we do properly RESTful nested calls, but we also on the back end are like, all right, we don't need it to all be transactional. We can, you know, take this one big blob of JSON and, you know, override the serializer class to create all the different models that we need or whatever. So kind of just like showing around that, like, we have these guide rails, but we can also be creative.
Yeah. Carlton and I recorded an episode, which probably came up before this, talking about Django REST framework and GraphQL and, because GraphQL is fantastic, but a lot of people maybe don't realize that you can do a lot with RESTful API structure and minimize a lot of the overhead without needing to go to GraphQL.
And that's one of the cool things about working on a smaller team is that we sit right next to, you know, all the engineers, and I can just shout over at my front end buddy, hey,
yeah,
you want me to make this easier on you?
Yeah. Well, so let's on the hiring front, so you mentioned, how does someone get hired with Django? What is a profile of, say, someone coming out of college or coming out of a boot camp? You know, should they have side projects? Should they be better, stronger in Python than Django? Like, what's some advice so that walk into the interview, you can say, oh, this is a person with upside?
So I think, first off, I focus a lot on communication, because I can hire an amazing developer who can build the world's greatest application, but if he can't communicate with anyone else sitting around him, then who cares?
And how do you evaluate that?
And how I evaluate that is I give them painfully easy interview questions. Which sounds backwards, right? So sometimes I will give like an algorithms question that is like everyone can get at least to the naive solution. Almost everyone can get to a better solution, and most people can make it to the ideal solution. Mm-hmm. And the goal is, I don't care about your code. I hand you the marker and I literally say to them, I'm here to judge your communication. I want to know what you're thinking about. I want to know how, you know, what your considerations are. And then simply based on whether or not they actually follow through. Because sometimes I'll say to them, like, oh, okay, cool, great, thanks for letting me know. And then they just pick up the marker and start coding and they don't say a word. And I'm like, I get you're nervous. But, you know, and one of the things that I like to do is, even if I always like to point out something that's wrong, even if it's not wrong, I'll be like, I don't know if that'll work the way you think it does it?
Just to force them to.
But also to frustrate them. Because that's the thing is, like, at the end of the day, the coworkers that you want to work with are the ones who can separate themselves and their ego from the code and the work being done.
Mm-hmm.
That's the important thing. So that's one way that I judge that. Another thing that we do at Path AI that I think is really unique, every single person that works here has given a presentation. I think maybe except for like the first three or four employees. So part of your interviews, you give a half hour presentation. The first 5 to 10 minutes of that is introducing yourself and most importantly, telling us why you want to interview at Path AI, why you want to work here.
Right. That's so important in startups.
Oh, yeah.
When I was hiring at Quizlet, you know, we found
it's hard to sell someone on the idea of startups if they're, you know, thinking about Google and startups. That's sort of a hard thing to win. If they've narrowed it, you know, I think a lot of times people think they feel bad about saying, well, I'm interviewing with your competitors. When in fact, if someone comes in and says, I'm interviewing at all these other medical startups or just all startups, that's a great thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Because then you know, you just have to sell against them. You don't have to worry about, you know, a big company or something.
Yeah. Well, I think to a point that you made when we were chatting previously was that like, if somebody comes in here and they're interviewing at Google, Amazon, Facebook, it's like, do you want to work at a startup or do you want to work at a massive corporation, which is fine. But like, if you want to be at Google, you're not going to have fun here.
That's what I found at Quizlet. Cause I worked a lot on hiring the early team and, you know, a lot of really smart young adults coming out of top schools. And if they were considering one of the big companies, 9 times out of 10, they were going to go there.
Yeah.
So it was a good pre-screen to say, why don't you figure that out on your own? And then once you're sure about startups, then I can tell you why this is the one for you.
Which I think is you should always be trying to do a service to the person that's interviewing.
Right.
Give them something to grow from if they're not the ideal candidate already.
And sometimes if you're, you know, in the interview seat, you can tell what someone wants better than they can. Like they may be trying to convince themselves of something, but
totally,
you know, there are just certain personality types that are better suited to bigger or smaller companies.
Yeah. I mean, I'm guilty of that myself as well in the past. We all have been, but I think that's a great learning experience, you know, for people.
Yeah. All right. So tee up an easy algorithm question is one of the things.
It's a 30-minute
presentation.
Yes.
So this is to a small
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the presentation, we invite everyone in the company. So again, everyone in the company gives...
For every candidate?
For every candidate. Now, not everyone shows up. Now, we got 58 people here, and I think, you know, some of those are remote, so maybe you'll have like 40 to 50 people in the office at any given day, and maybe like, you know, 10 to 20 will show up, especially based on the role. So for example, our front desk associate mm-hmm. gave a presentation, and I think a lot of people showed up to that because that's someone who, you know, affects
everyone's every going to interact. Yeah,
absolutely. Whereas like, you know, engineers, we'll get some front-end engineers, some back-end engineers, some, you know, we'll usually get some PMs and designers in there as well. And maybe even like IT or anyone really that's interested. Sometimes, you know, regulatory comes in because why not? Right.
And this is like a first round, like, is this like the early rounds or this is like right off the bat?
So this is the first step of your onsite. So for engineers, we do have
a hacker rank. Okay, so if they make it to onsite, okay.
Yeah, so we have a phone call with a recruiter, we have a hacker rank, and then you come on site. The first thing you do is you give this 30-minute presentation. And like I said, the beginning of this, you tell us about yourself, you tell us why you want to be here, and you know, a little bit about your background. But then the rest of the presentation is about a particularly thorny problem that you have solved in the past, whatever that might mean. So for me, you know, I alluded earlier to some low-level Flask hacking that I did at Wayfair. I actually got to present on that, and I think that was a really cool project where we were trying to, we had essentially pickle files that held weights for a given recommendation algorithm, and we wanted to retrain that every day. So that meant we needed to swap out that pickle file without any downtime, which was like actually an interesting problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to really get deep down into like the server hooks and everything to make that work. And I mean, we were serving it from a Samba share, so that was that was fun. But so, you know, you get to present on this problem, and again, it's about communication. It's not mm-hmm. always about, okay, is this the hardest problem on earth? Granted, obviously, choosing a good problem is part of the interview, really.
Yeah.
It's like your decision-making process. But it's really about how do you like tell us about the problem, set it up so that we know what the issue is, explain it to your audience properly. Because everyone at this company is hands-on, so we're all moderately technical. But if you have a UX designer in there, you don't want to start throwing around a bunch of hexadecimal values and not explain why you're doing so. So I think, you know, one of the things that I took to heart after my presentation was one of the designers said to me, you know, for back-end presentations, usually I understand 30 to 40%. You were able to explain this in a way that I understood like 85, 90% of what you were talking about. And when she told me that, I was like, okay, that probably means I did well. And that's really
what
you'd
already
for.
Been teaching for a number of years too, right? So you have a little bit of
you have
like
a huge advantage. Yeah, no, totally. Like, and that's, I mean, but you know, that's just the way it is, really. I mean, having an advantage is something. No, I am a public speaker, and I know that for most engineers, that's not their desired environment.
No, I mean, even a blog post is frightening for a lot of people. But
yeah,
but I'm biased towards feeling communication is important and practice is important. And ultimately, you know, I always think attitude over aptitude. Once you hit a base aptitude, it's really attitude. I mean, when I think of the people who haven't worked out in companies I've been in, it's almost always attitude. It's not aptitude. Absolutely. And often they have a high level of aptitude, which has gotten them to the point where they can get away with an attitude for a little bit. But, you know, if no one wants to work with the brilliant jerk.
No. And I mean, that's why we, you know, the DB factor. How much of a DB are you? You know, how much, you know, and like how nice of a person are you is really meaningful. And I usually, again, so communication's massive, but really the most important thing that I look for, especially in less experienced candidates, is coachability.
Mm-hmm.
So can I teach you something? Can anyone teach you something? Can you teach yourself, you know, independence, like the ability to sit down for a few hours, try to work through a really difficult issue, you know, look through the documentation, look through Stack Overflow, and then know when you have to say, all right, I need help. I'm going to go and ask somebody for help.
Yeah.
That's important to me, massively.
I agree. Well, I think we're getting near our time. Is there any other points you wanted to get in on there on Path AI, Django?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're scaling up in a massive way and we're building something that is massively useful. And I think it's just really exciting to get to be a part of a team that has a problem that we all can actually wake up in the morning and be like, I know why I'm going to work today. And I think it's great that we get to use Python doing this. Before I joined Path AI, I was going through like a severe identity crisis as a developer, so much so that I actually was looking through culinary school programs.
Oh, wow.
To be like, I don't want to write code anymore.
Well,
like,
you were probably what, five something years in professionally?
Professionally, I was...
Or where were you at?
Geez, I was like 6 or 7 years in.
I think that's not uncommon, though, that somewhere I've seen like 5 to 7 years in, you to have this sort of like midlife crisis where, you know, it's you have the confidence to know you can build anything, but you realize how hard things are and it's a little bit less shiny. And there's a little bit of a gut check on like, okay. And a lot of times it becomes doing things like mentoring or other things to kind of keep you interested in coding. I think it's pretty... A lot of disciplines, especially coding. Yeah, I think that's not uncommon.
Well, teaching keeps me humble. It reminds me, like, there are no stupid questions, because anyone who asks me a question says, oh, this might be a stupid question. I say, 6 or 7 years ago, I had the same question. So No, there's no stupid questions. There's only stupid people, and those are people who don't ask questions.
Right.
And, you know, so I think, like, given that and having the teaching, you know, was something that I was passionate about, and I wanted to keep doing that, even though if I didn't want to keep coding. But, you know, I took a solo trip, spent a week out in like Europe, just because I was lucky enough to do that. I was between jobs and I wanted to just kind of get my head straight and figure out what I want to do in my life. And I came back and there were just two things that stuck in my mind, which was, number one, I want to be writing web services in Python, because I'd gone back to Java for a brief period of time. It was like, nope.
That clarifies it. Yeah.
No. Back to, and I used to be a polyglot, I thought of myself as, but now I'm pretty confident that I'm a Pythonista, as much as I hate that word. But, you know, I also knew that I wanted to be in health technology, because at the end of the day, I've worked 70-hour weeks, week after week after week, building something that I didn't feel was a net positive to myself or the world. And if I have any opportunity of doing that, I feel like it's going to be in this space. And I'm about 6 months in and I still pinch myself every day, because I get to work at this company with insanely smart, insanely passionate people building really cool technology, and also doing it in like a less stressful environment, which is like, I don't know. I'm really lucky to be a part of Path AI, and I'm really glad that this exists, and that as time goes on, more and more companies like this are going to be cropping up, and we're actually going to be living better lives through technology.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, for developers who have some experience, who maybe want that extra meaning and realize that they can be more productive at 40 whatever hours a week instead of 80, I think that's a growing trend.
I hope so. I think the time of being, you know, a developer and being miserable, being intertwined is slowly ending. And I'm glad for that.
Well, thanks for so much for coming on the show, and we'll see everyone next time.
Thanks for having me. This was great.